Hello, everyone. This is Dark Journalist with a very special interview for you tonight with Antarctica Raytheon whistleblower Eric Hecker. Eric's bombshell information on the neutrino effect and its relationship to space communications in the UFO file is shaking the wall of secrecy to its foundation. Antarctica, the great mystery since Operation High Jump and Admiral Byrd, may be revealed tonight. Eric, it's great to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me, Daniel. I've been looking forward to this for a very long time. As I've mentioned to you before, that you're the only person that I see covering the Antarctic topic appropriately and trying to connect the dots to some of the most peculiar aspects of disclosure that are being wholly ignored.
There's no question there's a gigantic mystery there, and I appreciate it. I appreciated covering your work because you really have put a culmination to so many of the things that were going on in the background, going all the way back to Byrd and High Jump, and some of the things you observed actually being on the ground in Antarctica. I think it's so valuable, and the research that came later and all of the strange circumstances. So let's get into that now. What I want you to do is take us just on a journey about how you connected with Antarctica in the first place, and then we'll get into the deeper aspects as we go along.
Absolutely, sir. It was back in the debacle of the real estate bubble bursting around 2008-ish that the I had a small service plumbing company on Long Island doing plumbing and heating repairs 24 hours a day, and that's where I was at the time. After having a career working for other people and very peculiar facilities all over Long Island, TRW, AIL, SAIC, Grumman, Paul Corporation.
Oh wow.
Both the facilities and the people that owned these facilities. So I had a very peculiar client list, but when things were fading financially there, I had to start broadening my horizons and where else can I find work. Oddly enough, the only place on the planet that I was able to get to cut me a check and give me a contract was Raytheon Polar Services. So I wound up signing up with those folks. I went down to Centennial, Colorado for some training and testing and all that type of stuff, psychological evaluations and fire brigade training, emergency first responder stuff, Wilderness Medicine Institute, Knowles, and just a whole bunch of training and prepping. And then effectively, they flew us down to Christchurch, New Zealand, then to McMurdo Station. This was in November of 2010.
Wow.
So I wound up making it to Pole that November, and I was on site 366 days straight on the ice before I departed in November of 2011.
It's incredible. What is it like to be in Antarctica?
It's really hard to give it the words that it deserves.
Yeah.
There's nothing there. I mean, when you land at South Pole, when they open up the door to the Herc and that atmosphere comes in, it is like a punch in the face. It was minus 50 degrees ambient when we arrived. It's 0% humidity, super low oxygen. So, we exit the plane and they have, that your gear is on an Air Force pallet on the ice already. And you're supposed to go over and grab your stuff and carry it in. And wow. I mean, I was 36 years old at the time and perfectly fit, working in the trades and, having a good understanding of, what I could accomplish physically. And then I went over to grab my stuff and I felt like an emphysema patient. It was like just... wow. Everything was heavy and hard to lift. And it was so funny because I remember there was a girl that had come out of the elevated station that had wintered over. And I knew this because she had almost no cold weather gear on. She had just a thermal, a t-shirt, a hat on her head, gloves on her hands, like no skin exposed, except for her face, but no jacket or anything. Cause in her mind's eye, she was just coming out and going in and grabbing people's stuff and helping. And she just started grabbing bags and humping them into the building with great ease. And I remember thinking to myself, I wish she would carry me in. Like, you know, but how, yeah, how's it going to look if on the first day, you know, the first chick I meet, I'm like, can you throw me over your shoulder and bring me in? Don't tell HR I said that.
Well, that's great. Well, she, I guess, you know, the training and everything, just acclimating to the whole place, she had it.
Absolutely. But,
that's fascinating.
Yeah, she was totally there. Acclimated.
Did you get a sense for, like, you know, the idea of when Bird first hit with his expedition there? Did you get a feel for what it was like, just the environment? And I know there's a great deal of difference. There's like 70 years difference between when he went there. But just that feeling of being out on the edge of the universe kind of thing.
Absolutely. The being in the environment puts a lot of stuff in context. So I feel that I do understand a lot more of where Bird and other, you know, previous old Antarctic explorers' minds were at. Granted, you know, for what we had for a facility would be considered super lush and easy for them. But
yes.
You can immediately respect that without these facilities and this infrastructure, it's just ice hell.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, so you immediately have things put in perspective, because you can look in one direction and you can see the elevated station and you're like, yay, we can live there. But you could just turn and look in the other direction and you see the nothingness, and you can immediately imagine the horror it would have had to have been to trek in there with the gear that they had. One of the coolest experiences that I had was in my summer season. They set us up in the conference room, and we actually wound up, there was some sort of a reunion that was going on for the original military crew that was the first winter overs in 1957.
Oh, wow.
And we got to do a conference call with them, and they were sharing their stories with us of what it was like for them to show up and set up the first facility to ever winter at the South Pole Station.
And that's part of the International Geophysical Year.
Yes, sir.
The whole IGY, which is still shrouded in secrecy and probably never really ended. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which was started by Berkner, if I recall.
Exactly. Yes. And it's interesting. He came up with the idea in 1950, 7 years, 7 years in construction. And of course, it coincides with satellites and everything. It's just, oh, so convenient. And it never, the funding for it never ended.
No, that's the United States Antarctic Program, now operating under the auspices of the National Science Foundation.
Yes, exactly. And this is what's fascinating to me, because that corridor for funding is there, even without the black budget part, which we'll get into. Mm-hmm. So you're there, and you're in the middle of this whole mystery, and you're working, you have this full-time job. You are basically the all-around guy there. You're the contractor, you're the fireman, electrician, plumber, everything that they need. And so it gives you access to all different parts of the facility.
We did technically have a full complement of specialists.
Okay.
I was effectively the plumber / fire brigade team lead. But we did have electricians. You know, we had vehicle maintenance folks, but basically, the way things that worked was that if something broke and it was a plumbing issue, I would take lead, and then the other trades would be like my apprentices, and then vice versa. If it was a massive electrical failure, the electrician, he takes lead, and then we all help. And that would be when I would say there was like a catastrophic failure. So I was hired as a plumber by contract, but that would be more for the summer season that I was very specific to that role. Mm-hmm. During the winter season, when we dropped down to a skeleton crew, I operated in a department known as FEMC, Facilities, Engineering, Maintenance, and Construction. And in that capacity, in the winter time, I was operating under a role that they called a utilities technician. So in the normal operations, non-emergency stuff, I could get involved with little rinky-dink, you know, electrical repairs. You know, if the electrician's doing a big overhaul somewhere down, you know, in the facility, and we have a light switch go out, yeah, of course, I'll take care of that. You're busy, you know, that type of stuff.
Yeah.
So that was normal operations. We did a lot of, you know, just preventative maintenance checks. I mean, we pretty much had to go into every room in every building every day. To just check, make sure everything's okay, you know, make sure nothing's squeaking or creaking or smoking, or, you know, just check everything. It was obligatory, because any failure that occurred there would cascade very rapidly. We would always say, you know, we have to get something fixed rapidly because, like, Mother Nature is now encroaching and she's ruthless at the South Pole. I mean, that was one of the things that I realized during my winter season. Like, oftentimes I was literally like Lieutenant Dan in Forrest Gump, like out in whiteout conditions, trying to walk to another building and screaming into the wind at Mother Nature, like, you're not going to get me today. Because it's wow. obvious that Mother Nature has designed that area for nothing to be alive.
Wow. Yeah, absolutely. Right?
She doesn't want anything to be alive there. And you're going against that every step, every second. And it's, you know, I had a lot of conversations where I didn't speak nicely to her.
Exactly. You're there in this capacity, and over time, let's say some unusual things happen, or you witness some different types of technologies that are used, which you have no idea what they are back there. When you leave, it starts to occur to you, oh, I was witnessing some very, very strange things while I was there. How long is the arc there before it starts to sink in that there were very strange things that you witnessed?
Actually, that's close to completely accurate, with the only caveat being is that I did discover the ELF system was wholly functional while I was present in the facility. Oh, and I had a short stint in the submarine service, so I'm very aware of the potentials of what the ELF can be utilized for. And we were told initially that that system was off and not operational. But in my duties, I had a repair to do where I learned that that system was up and running. So even while I was there, I was like kind of floored that I was like, I knew it. I knew Raytheon was up to something here.
Yeah.
You know, but then in regards to the other technologies, when I did get off of the ice, yes, it did take a few years for me to start connecting the dots. And the, I guess you would say the motivation for that activity was when I started to notice some issues with my health. And then I started having other crew members reach out to me that they were having issues with their health. At the time, we weren't familiar with the Havana syndrome stuff, or AHI as they're calling it now. So we were just trying to figure out, like, what's going on? Like, what happened? Certainly, I have no love loss on Raytheon. I consider them the devil incarnate in corporate form. So for them to have damaged us without telling us, just it seemed like par for the course and very reasonable logic. You know, we had a lot of issues with Raytheon, even, you know, while we were on site. So this to me just seemed like a continuation of they effed us over hard yet again.
So it's this defense contractor with low regard for the people that are working there and subjecting them to very hazardous conditions. What is the kind of main symptom you would say that came out of this for you? So you're exposed to this machine. Some members of the crew are exposed to the ELF. And what starts to happen?
First and foremost, I would say it seems almost the entire list from myself and the folks on the crew. But if you want to go into, like, say, main issues, I would say, like, unnecessary fatigue, brain fog, you know. And I know people, I mean, if you're not suffering this stuff, it might sound like it's nothing. But it's, it's the weirdest thing in the world to have to go through. Skin issues have been reported by other crew members. You know, cognitive decline prematurely. You know, so again, these things don't sound that terrible until it's happening to you. But this is also why I've also come out, because what occurred to my crew, because we were in proximity and, you know, probably being wholly tested on by Raytheon because they didn't give a damn about us. But it's my belief that these directed energy weapons platforms are now being more broadly applied to the general population. And I often suggest to people, you know, pay attention to your loved ones, learn what the symptoms are on the Havana syndrome symptoms list, and start paying attention to your own loved ones, because truly we're only going to be able to be the judges and jury on the discrepancies. because they happen gradually, and people are changing in the general community now. Like I would say I'm witnessing the people around me in the general population suffering these symptoms. But if you don't know someone's firing a weapon at you and it's invisible, you don't realize that you're now the modern walking wounded.
Interesting. Wow. And Havana syndrome, of course, was picked up initially by these government workers after we reestablished the embassy there in Cuba. And somebody didn't want that to happen. And they started to come down with things like they would call them microwave concussions. One of the weird things that I noticed in those stories, if you go into it, is after the personnel were called back to the United States, the symptoms continued. The syndrome continued to stalk them. And that sounds like it's the same thing in your experience.
Yeah, I think of it again, like from my submarine experience, I'm cognizant that, you know, you can get a sound signature off of anything. And then at that point, that's your target. You know, you just dial in. So once they got your number, it doesn't really matter where you go. And and once you're part of the experiment and you're unbeknownst, I mean, there's no reason for them to stop.
Right, right. Absolutely. And some of those aspects that get into mind control and things are interesting. You brought them up. And I am going to ask you about those. What I want to ask you about has been something central that you observed and has to do with this neutrino ice cube detector and the strange technology that's associated with it. And then the aspect of observing this earthquake take place in Christchurch as a result of this exotic technology. Bring us into that and how it started to, you know, you put the pieces together that the things people were telling you when you were there were directly related to this earthquake that took place.
Fair enough. And that was an aspect that I would say I connected the dots after the fact, albeit I was present when the Ice Cube Neutrino Detector, Ice Cube Lab, sometimes it's called, and the elevated station were transitioning from their construction phases to operations and maintenance. I was officially the first crew to function either of those facilities in operations and maintenance. So the Ice Cube Neutrino facility went online when I was present.
Wow. And this is 2011? Crew. Is that right? 2010?
Yes, sir. Yes. February of 2011 was Got when it effectively started coming online. And that was when the earthquakes occurred in Christchurch, New Zealand. It was a big deal for the Antarctic program because we had just switched from summer operations to winter operations. We had a ton of personnel transiting through Christchurch. There's a big, you know, try to find the missing personnel. There was all kinds of call lists. And if you've seen this person, let us know. And they were, you know, going through it. It was a very big deal. But it wasn't until years later when I was communicating with former crew members, and again, I was suspect of people on my crew operating under false pretenses. Let's just say spooks. I mean, to me, in my experience, it there was no way that certain people on that crew weren't spooks, and I was aware of that the entire time.
They were undercover.
Absolutely. And I've spoken to folks like Walter Bosley, who, you know, we've engaged and discussed exactly how these types of things work. And they show up and say, I'm the electrician, but they're actually there for, you know, for AFOSCI to, you know, check for leaks, you know, to make sure that there's not intelligence getting out. So even in my conversations with Walter, I said, you know, if you could have gotten a job, because he has said on air, you know, that he had applied to go to Antarctica. So I caught that as a little red flag to me. And I was like, Walter, like, what do you mean you guys had an option to go to Antarctica? I said, and he explained, well, you know, yeah, I would have been under false pretenses. I would have shown up as an airman, you know, or a fueler or whatever, but effectively he was intelligence. Right. And I said to him, I said, if that's the case, Walter, I said, if the Air Force would do that for a benign project, I said, hypothetically, if everything that I'm saying is true and there's more nefarious activities going on, I said, wouldn't there be like a guy like you doing that for that project? He was like, oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
I think we had those guys. And in the post ICE deployment, when we started communicating that there were health issues and people were asking me to put all of my cards on the table, you know, for the benefit of our crew and our health and what can we accomplish, I demanded reciprocity. Mm-hmm. So put all your cards on the table. I said, I know that there was more going on at your desk. So it was in these communications that I basically got read into what was really going on, which was the directed energy's weapons capacity of the facility, which made total sense as to why we were having health issues. And there was a lot of situations that we then discussed where I now know that we were lied to. We would run mass casualty incident drills. You know, again, I was a high-ranking member of the emergency response team. The fire brigade that I was on, I was effectively always the first person to breach the door into what we would call a red zone. We followed the FEMA incident management protocols, and basically Team 2 Fire Brigade would breach the area after Team 1 would go and, you know, basically the alarms would go off. I would run to my gear locker, start bunkering up, full SCBA, and get ready to fight fires and rescue victims. Team 1 was the first responders. They would basically go immediately to the location that was ringing the alarm, and they would confirm that it's a legitimate alarm, and they would secure the area, and they would start defining what we would call a red zone, a yellow zone, and a green zone, basically hot, warm, and cold zone. So the only people that can go into the red zone had to be on air, full SCBA. And that was my job, was once the red zone was declared, I would have to go in with the resources that I would dictate to mitigate the problem. Every one of the aspects of the facility I had to get trained up on. We had to have standard operating procedures, emergency access plans, what's in there, what can hurt people, what has to be de-energized, you know, what kind of compressed gases are in there, all kinds of stuff. So there were some drills that we did. Where, as an example, out in a communications area, one of the radar domes, we were setting up a drill to do a mass casualty incident event out there, because it was kind of like at the outskirts of the property, kind of really far away from the elevated facility, and the resources would all have to be transited there. It was a logistical nightmare in those temperatures, for our SCBAs were not designed for that. The equipment is, you know, challenging. You can run a piston bully out there, but you can't park it. You got to keep it moving, you know, circling around and stuff like that. So it was really a test to put us through the ringer and test our gear and stuff. In that process, when we were getting the emergency action plan together, one of the, you know, checked boxes that we had to do was that, you know, before we go into this radome, it has to be de-energized. We can't send personnel into this thing when it's transmitting.
Right.
So I found out
in this whole,
yeah, absolutely. It's RF frequency poisoning and stuff like that. It already has signs on the door like "do not enter when transmitting," you know, dangerous for personnel. So, you know, we took this into consideration, and everybody agreed that, all right, you know, that's going to have to be de-energized for the drill. And, you know, it was all part of the process. Well, I found out in hindsight, years later, they just lied to us. It turned out that it was too necessary to keep the equipment on, apparently.
Oh,
so that when we did the drill, and we called in, you know, I'm at the door ready to breach, and I call in and I said, okay, you know, de-energize the system. We're getting ready to breach the door, and I got a call back. You know, the system has been de-energized. It is safe for you to enter the building. Well, what I learned years later was they just lied. They're like, yeah, just tell them we de-energized it.
And it's fascinating because when you get into those types of things, they could have been checking you out medically and seeing what kind of effects were taking place and all the rest of it. They get all that data while exposing you to that whole thing. What is the strangest piece about the earthquake taking place there during the test, in that there was some rumors around the base, I presume, or just among your crew, that the test that they were doing on the neutrino effect was the direct result of what took place with the earthquake, but it wasn't intentional. But then later you discovered, oh, no, it was intentional.
Yeah. So I would say at the time that I was on the ice and present, that there weren't rumors running around at that moment that we had induced the earthquake. It wasn't until later on. But when I was going over things with the crew, the original idea that I was being told was that it was an accident. And then it was friendly fire, and it was just because that, you know, they didn't have it dialed in yet, you know, so they had to, you know, work on their targeting, so to say. But just like I no longer believe the radome was turned off for our mass casualty incident, that they lied about it. I think they lied about that too. I think there is a possibility that it was on purpose. And I had come across a document that was a WikiLeaks document that was apparently from the desk of Hillary Clinton. And I'm gonna paraphrase a little bit. But the concept of this email was referencing the earthquakes in Christchurch, New Zealand in February of 2011. And she said something to the effect of that she was happy that it occurred and on cue.
Oh, yes, yes.
So that changed
my
mind.
That tells you a great deal there, Secretary of State.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. You, when you think about that, what do you think is taking place there? We've heard now all the way back to, you know, particle beam weapons, and Nikola Tesla in 1903, simulated an earthquake in Manhattan on a dare, and the police made him stop. Right. So this has been around, the idea of creating earthquakes, creating weather events, and the whole disaster capitalism that goes along with it. But this one basically is, you have this test going on by Raytheon there in Antarctica, and it results directly somehow, because it's aimed at Christchurch, in the earthquake there. And then, you know, whether it's accidental or they did it on purpose as a test, and it seems like they did it on purpose. We've seen over and over again, there are little hints that some of these major earthquake events are being caused by this technology. What do you think it is in the technology? And would you say definitively that you think we possess a DEW that can set off an earthquake?
Absolutely, I believe that we do. I believe it's right at South Pole Station. This is why I fight this battle, is that everybody is saying, you know, if this stuff was true, if somebody knew something, they would say something. Well, I am, because I know something. So I'm saying something.
Right.
This is what's called actionable intelligence, right? You know, a lot of these other whistleblowers are out there, and they're not really giving actionable intelligence, right? The way I look at it is like, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not the judge and jury, right? But I am providing enough actionable intelligence that if there was to be a grand jury, they'd be able to indict and move forwards and do an investigation, which is what I went to Washington, D.C. for in good faith, is I don't believe that I have the whole case lock, stock, and barrel. But I've provided enough actionable intelligence that it deserves people looking into this further.
But you're bringing in that huge puzzle piece, and it's coming in from a very obscure corner, which is Antarctica, and the testing that's going on down there, the presence of the defense contractors like Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, and others, and the secrecy levels that they're under. Not to mention the fact that if you really get into the history there, the UFO file aspect comes into that. I'm going to get into that with you. What I want to ask you on this is, when you went to Washington and they put you in a skiff to give this information.
Two of them. One was the Senate Intelligence Committee and one was Arrow.
Oh, fascinating. And Arrow, of course, set up directly to get to the bottom of the UFO file originally, and you know, turned out to be a complete whitewash.
Totally.
Did you, what was your impression of the people you were giving the information to? And do you think they received it on the level that you were delivering it?
It was funny how diametrically opposed those skiffs were. the Senate Intelligence Committee skiff was run by Kirk McConnell, who I didn't know at the time. I had no idea who he was. From my perspective that day, I just thought he was like a really smart scientist that was really nice. Like, he was very smiley. He was very amicable. But he was like a kid in the candy store. You know, I spread out all of my information all over the table. There was other people in the room, but he was the one basically running it. He was like the point of contact for everyone else. He was asking the questions. People had questions for me. They would ask him first, and he would kind of give his interpretation and redistribute the information back. So that was fantastic. That skiff, like I left there feeling like I had accomplished something and that it was worth me going to Washington, D.C. They absolutely, you know, thanked me for my, you know, braveness to testify, told me my information was going to be put in the National Archives and, you know, we're going to get to the bottom of this, you know. But the folks at Arrow, it was just, it was like everything that I was telling them was nowhere near anything they heard before. They didn't know how to connect it to anything. They were just like, just question askers.
Interesting. You know?
Yeah. So that it was, that one was a bit more disheartening because it just seemed like, you know, that my information was, it wasn't that it's so much that it was falling on deaf ears, so to say, it was just falling on, we'll go biblical. Those people had neither eyes to see nor ears to hear. They didn't know what was going on when I was talking.
Oh, right. Right. And that could be the position coming in that, you know, we can neither confirm nor deny. So we're just going to sit here and ask you the questions like we don't know anything. But it's also interesting to consider that if they're that out of the loop, then, you know, there's so few people that come directly from a facility or having worked for a defense contractor in Antarctica who can come out and say this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've had some kind of fluff stuff that's come out that said, hey, there's a pyramid over here, you know, and that kind of things. And, you know, I believe some of the stories that go back around Pyramid of Alaska and things of that nature, but nothing, Antarctica, in my opinion, it's harder to get real, genuine intelligence out of there than it is on the moon. You know, it's so remote and under such a veil of secrecy because of its importance. And the question of why it's so important intrigues me. One of our mutual friends, John Warner IV, talks a great deal about his dad, who was Secretary of the Navy and a great senator from Virginia. And in conversations with him, even he was holding out and being highly secretive, but he indicated that the program that he was involved in, Deep Freeze, in Antarctica, was related directly to space. And so I want to get into your research around that. You've been there, you've been in the middle of that maelstrom of the secrecy. What is it that relates Antarctica to space, in your opinion?
That besides the ability to induce earthquakes from the Ice Cube facility, that how do I put this? So, you know, we'll just say UFOs. Obviously, there's off-world ones. I'm not opposed to there being life in the cosmos and them having ships, and I'm not opposed to them coming here. But I believe that would be the most minute amount of observations of the activities that we're seeing. I believe most of the stuff that we see is man-made technology that's just monopolized technology. And this, you know, they're hiding it away so that it's unregulated. But those, all of these vehicles that we're now discussing have exotic propulsion systems that, from what I'm learning, most likely eject neutrinos as part of their propulsion process. So the Ice Cube neutrino detector would effectively be like an air traffic control tower to observe the flight paths of these vehicles. You know, most of our radar systems can't track these things because they, it's the way the technology functions. It can only track things that go up to a certain speed. And then on the screen, it'll start to look like something skipping across the screen because it's only getting a flash of it at different points. So it gives that weird signature. No human craft can do that. Well, if it goes really fast, it can. It'll just look like that. That peculiar thing is exactly how it'll look on a radar screen if it's just screaming across the sky. You would need another form of observation to track our own equipment moving at great speed.
Interesting.
A standard radar will never function for high-speed human air travel.
You know, this is fascinating to me, and I want to put this to you is what is the, you know, the crisscross between these two events? If you go all the way back to Operation High Jump and Admiral Byrd's expedition there, now he had already been there on a couple of different occasions. This was the big going back with everybody, you know, it's the biggest expedition of all time to Antarctica at the time. But what he observed were craft when he got there. And we all know the whole thing turned around and got out of there when they were supposed to spend all this time there. No, in fact, you know, it was a much shorter enterprise. And he came back with stories that we're in between wars. We're going to be at wars with whatever we saw down there. And there was this whole thing about the discs and everything else. So he encountered some level of UFO activity. Maybe he was thinking, you know, this is some other group. These are aliens or these are Germans. And because this is after the war, it's 46 into 47. But the fact that they turn around and that he's really kept tightly and tight-lipped for the rest of his career about this. And there are other strange things that happened in relation to High Jump to keep the secrecy level. Then flash forward to this detector and what you're saying about the air traffic control of UFOs. I want you to put those two together for me, because if he was seeing UFOs as a place of origin there down in Antarctica, a base, as it were, that spooked them and they thought, you know, we need to get the hell out of here. And this may have been part of the things that they observed down there in the first place, which is why you have people like Lloyd Berkner, who we've talked about extensively, the physicist who went down there with him originally all the way back in 1928. And then these guys show up later and they are running UFO panels, the Robertson panel and the International Geophysical Year. These things, to me, when I was listening to your account about this air traffic control of UFOs via this experimental exotic technology, that started to connect for me. Oh, this is a part of a trend going on decades, you know, now 100 years of this. And this is the culmination that you're talking about, as they decided this is the point where we can observe them. And this is also the point where the stuff that we've redeveloped, this is how we track it.
I see the Ice Cube, the Ice Cube arrays, you know, it's basically, you know, a phased array transmitter as well. And as you know, that, you know, Berkner originally requested monies for research in Antarctica, because he said we need to start paying attention to the activities of what's moving on and off through the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. I would just say that in 2011, the best system we had for that came online, as Berkner requested. It just took this long for us to have this capacity.
Excellent. Yes, that is an incredible point. And so they've achieved that level. And then 6 years or so after the fact, suddenly the intelligence agencies are willing to come out with their version of the UFO file and their people presenting it and all the rest of it. You and I have seen these people come out. You've seen them up close in Washington and all the rest. Mm-hmm. And when you did the Stephen Greer event, you were exposed to all that. And I will say that I think that that event did sort of put your story more on the radar. And I think it's gone out there, but I still don't think people realize the impact of what's been going on with this aspect of Antarctica and the research that you're bringing forward on it. So if you had to kind of sum it up in this sense, that thing that you're talking about, which is basically like some version of HAARP.
Yes.
Yes.
It's kind HAARP of testing on steroids.
Yes.
Exactly. So like the Kokona facility, which I've gone and visited that area a couple of times, like a HAARP system is on a two-dimensional plane. It has length and width. So it's a phased array transmitter with only two dimensions. Whereas the Ice Cube neutrino array also goes down into the Earth with great depth. So it has length, width, and depth. It has a third dimension, which increases it like magnitudes. So it's HAARP on steroids.
Incredible. The implications there are dramatic, that we finally got something where we could put our own advanced craft into a separate system to track. Mm-hmm. And that Antarctica would be the main station for that. But also we could be watching the traffic coming to and fro that goes outside of the bounds of the things we're aware of.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I don't believe just that there's U.S. factions involved. I think I do not believe the government is the top of the pyramid when it comes to technology. I mean, people don't realize the government doesn't manufacture anything. They purchase stuff from manufacturers. So those manufacturers can certainly, like, if I want to, if I own Lockheed Martin and you own Raytheon, and you and I are competing with each other, we are selling our products to other people so that they can war with each other. There's no reason for you and I not to maintain better equipment, right? Yes. If you're going to arm other armies, the smartest thing that you could ever do would be to make sure that you can still outgun them.
Right.
So I believe the corporations technologically have the greatest equipment out there, and the military has crap compared to what these guys have. But now the corporations have all of the money. I mean, you might have heard, Daniel, that some politicians, you know, get paid to do what corporations tell them to.
Right. Yeah.
So I think what we're witnessing with the whole disclosure thing right now, that everybody's barking up the wrong tree.
Yeah.
They're trying to get the truth from the government when the truth is bought and, I'm sorry, the government is bought and paid for by the corporations to be the wall, to be the gatekeepers. They don't have access to the truth. They don't have access to the technology. It is not in the hands of the government. This is one of the things that we got to in the SCIFs, was the everything basically reduced down to, now that we know that there are rogue factions operating without oversight from the government, and therefore we the people, what do we do? The government already knows it's not in control.
Interesting. Yes. So this factor,
and there's nothing they can do about it. Like, we're already there. The government is not in control of the vast amounts of high technology. So I like the work that, like, Walter Bosley does and Joseph P. Farrell. I love when they talk about the breakaway civilization stuff. Like, where that has been going on for a really long time. And as of their recent research, they're pushing this back now into the 1860s.
Yes. Yeah, with the airship mystery. There's no question about it. What's interesting to me is the inflection point becomes Antarctica. Mm-hmm. Because somehow it becomes the center of secret research, to a point where I think something like Area 51 is down the chain.
Absolutely.
Because if you are in that obscure location, you are highly undetectable. And you're also in conditions that are very hard to duplicate if you're another country trying to figure out what we're doing.
It's a logistical nightmare for people to try to eavesdrop on each other over there, so to say.
Yes, absolutely.
Even though technically the Antarctic Treaty affords that all of the signatories have carte blanche to go check out everybody else's facilities to make sure they're on the up and up. How come no one does that? Right. How come no one does that?
It's an extraordinary treaty. And that whole era of the late 50s for this is extraordinary, because Berkner shows up like this Zelig type figure in the UFO file in Antarctica, meeting with JFK as he's about to be assassinated. You know, he's on his way to meet Berkner to do this final speech. I did a whole documentary on it.
I watched that. It was fantastic.
Yeah. You know, what's amazing to me about Berkner is he's in the heart of this. He was working at the end of his life with James McDonald, of course. And then he died very suddenly in the middle of giving a speech to this think tank at a relatively early age, 62 years old. And I wondered there if this figure, who is, you know, I talk about these factions being ex-protect and ex-share. It seems to me he was right between the two, because he was against SAC and against that level of secrecy, but he wasn't, he wasn't quite coming out to the public. And it's quite possible that his speech with Kennedy was going to move the needle dramatically in this direction. When I mentioned the Kennedy piece there around Antarctica, I just want to bring up Bird again and get your reflections on this with your own research around Antarctica. When we find that the person who owned the Texas School Book Depository was Harold Dryhold Bird, and that he is the cousin of Admiral Bird, and that he owns an experimental aerospace company, does that, and the fact that Kennedy's going to meet Berkner, with all your knowledge of these secret weapons development and Antarctica and the fact that you've actually been there, how does that strike you?
It's collusion. It's like this is why I love the work that you're doing, because I find it, it's like, it's irrefutable. You can't say that this stuff means nothing.
Right.
You know, to me, like the stuff that you're putting out there is some of the, like the biggest dots connected ever. I mean, you know, I'm going to shamelessly plug you like I do in a lot of other places. I mean, I tell people all the time, because like, you know, because of what I do, people often say like, you know, Eric, you throw stones at everyone in Disclosure, and you're a pig because you say everybody's a liar and everybody's off the track. And I go, that's not true. I said, I keep telling people to watch Dark Journalists. I said, this one guy, this one guy that's putting it together. I said, I throw stones at everyone else because they are full of crap. I said, watch Dark Journalists. I said, and as I do say, watch Walter Bosley and Joseph P. Farrell also.
Yeah. Oh, yes. You guys, absolutely.
You guys are like the holy trinity of truth right now.
Well, I'll tell you what's fascinating in your work, which is I looked at so many different pieces with Antarctica, and mostly I had to go far, far into the past to get anything that would kind of move the needle on it all. It wasn't until you came out and brought the neutrinos in the Christchurch earthquake into view around this that Antarctica, you know, we had all the strangeness about John Kerry coming down when he was Secretary of State, and he is, you know, just before the Obama administration is out, he's down there in Antarctica, and they're inviting Buzz Aldrin at the same time, and, you know, basically the Pope of Russia, these other people, and it's a highly auspicious, unusual crew, shall we say, and Aldrin has to be medically evacuated, probably for the same reason you were talking about. The conditions there are just so intense, but also having one of the most famous NASA astronauts come down there, how does that strike you?
It's odd. Anytime people of any level of importance go there, it seems very weird to me because, I mean, it's the term they say all the time. It's a harsh effing continent. It's unforgiving. And it's not like anywhere else in the world where if anything goes wrong, anything can be done about it. There's not the logistical support that's everywhere else on the planet. To the best of my knowledge, no one's ever been rescued from an incident in the middle of Antarctica. You either make it from point A to point B or you're done. So the danger that I was in being there is the same danger that these dignitaries exposed themselves to. You know, it doesn't matter, you know, how many Secret Service agents you have next to you on the flight. If the plane goes down, you all freeze to death.
Right.
There's no extra protection that works against Mother Nature there. It's you versus Mother Nature. Incredible. So they're all taking that risk on, which I don't understand why these people are taking that risk on. Normally we protect people like that and buffer them from danger. So anytime a dignitary went down there, I found it the weirdest thing in the world. In my summer season, I got mad because there are rich people that go down to South Pole and they pay exorbitant amounts of money to pretend that they skied there. They lie. They fly in and they take out their skis and then they go over to the pole and they take their hero shot and they all, you know, tell their friends, I skied to the, but they're lying. and one time I was coming out of doing my rounds in the emergency power plant and I opened the door and I looked and there was a child in the hallway. Oh, one of the kids of one of these rich people. And I thought, I'm like, who the hell would bring their kid here and subject them to this danger? I wanted to slap the snots out of the parents.
I was
like, here, you guys are idiots.
That's some kind of tourism. My God.
Yeah. Let me bring my 8-year-old to South Pole.
Well, it is so interesting. To me, when I think about the UFO aspect in relation to this, so I'm going to back up and say, when you came out at the Greer event, you were talking about all the things you'd observed there in Antarctica and your research since. And this medical aspect with the Havana syndrome, by the way, is that a legal case at this point?
Not on my part. I can't get traction or help from anybody. I mean, I went in good faith to Washington, D.C., spoke to the Senate Intelligence Committee, nothing happened. I spoke to Arrow. They lied about my testimony when they gave their summary report.
They stated
in their summary report that they got reports of victims of Havana syndrome from every continent except for Antarctica. Ugh. I almost fell out of my chair.
You were like, I put that on the record already.
That's exactly what I went there to accomplish. Mm-hmm. And they said that no one reported that.
What an incredible whitewash of an institution. It's incredible. Mm. And they're obviously holding up that wall of secrecy. Mm. When you think about the UFO file, secret space program, these covert space activities in relation to some of the research and experience you had down there, what do you see happening in relation to, I think that you suggested at a certain point, they were using this exotic technology for communications purposes in deep space.
That's where you just were sending my brain. I was hoping you were going to bring that up. Back to the research that Bosley and Farrell are doing, they're pushing back the timeline for airship activities on world, and then it begs the question, at what point was it off world?
Yeah.
And how far could they go? Mm-hmm. Obviously, if we start sending people outward, we're going to need a means of communication.
Mm-hmm.
And I do also believe that in the transmit mode, a phased array transmitter, which is at the South Pole Station, could function in this, is, you know, high level tech of quantum entangled faster than light communication, so that if there is a fleet out there, which, you know, like Gary McKinnon had, you know, broken into the NASA files and said, you know, this is a list of off world ships and this is the list of the captains. Well, okay.
Then exactly. We're going to have to be able to off world personnel. Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to have to be able to communicate with those people, right?
Yeah,
I mean, we put submarines in the ocean and we have very high level technology to be able to communicate with underway submarines in secret.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if there is, in fact, an off-world fleet, well, obviously we're going to need comms.
Yes. This is a fantastic and very black project for developing this. So it's probably been under development since about 1928, if you think about the radio setup of Radio America and all the things that took place there. By now, this is a very important piece of it, because when you get to 1972 and they cut off any kind of manned moon missions, there's no explanation for it. And when they go to say, well, we're coming back, we're doing the Artemis program, you know, it's like, what happened 52 years in between? So all of that infrastructure has been developed. Something's been going on. Something's been developed in that period.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And this, I think, gets to the heart of it.
I couldn't argue with that logic and reasoning. It's just, I think things just went dark.
Yes.
That's all. They just put it behind the veil of secrecy and gave us the shenanigans. I mean, there's really no reason that we couldn't have continued the what was presented as the standard operation for moon travel. You know, of course we lost the blueprints, we lost the videos, it's all shenanigans in my book. I mean, I didn't even believe that as a kid. I didn't even understand how could we not be going back to the moon. And even now, you know, as an adult and doing research, I've learned that, you know, the shuttle program that we were all enamored with as children, I came across stuff that said that, you know, like when NASA was first trying to get funded, for the shuttle program, for the funding they were requesting, they were claiming there was going to be 2 shuttle launches a week.
Wow.
How'd that work out for the return on investment?
Incredible. Wow. I think it's interesting, and we have from astronauts like the late Gordon Cooper, that the Mars mission was all set. And it was set in 1966 and then again set for 1981. He heard about both missions.
Oh, wow.
One of them he was supposed to lead. But the training that took place was supposed to have taken place in Antarctica. That's what's interesting to me. Somehow the conditions there are, you know, to open them up to what space life would be like and also what living on another planet would be like. There's a piece back there, a book called Two Planets. which was a great inspiration to guys like von Braun, who went on to, after serving the Hitler V2 rockets up, went on to lead our NASA program. My question is, and this guy Liswitz is quite fascinating, because what he puts across is that this Martian civilization come here, and the place that they go to are the North Pole and the South Pole. Those are the conditions. And it's very interesting. It seems like somebody who's dimed into a level of information, and this was written in 1898.
Oh, geez.
It's almost like that arc, once you get to it, and once you get the real rocket pioneers, there's some crisscross with Antarctica that shows up, and then the Nazi fascination with Antarctica, and the fact that they got Byrd to advise them, and, you know, before we were at war, of course, and he gave them all this advice, and they said, we want to go down there for whaling purposes. we know there was a plan in there about developing new Schwabenland. My question is, Antarctica is the focus of all this secret activity. And if you look at it in terms of the coverage that we get on it, on the alternative side with the independent media, it doesn't go very deep, does it?
No, not at all. I would equate it again to back to my experience with submarines, is that it's such a controlled topic. Right. Anything that you see in the media about United States submarines is curated by the submarine service.
Right.
Nothing out in the public that they didn't approve. Like that's, you know, it's like that with Antarctica, I believe, which is why I came out from the angle that I came out with, was like, you know, if there's other rogue factions, I'm a rogue faction. I'm fighting those rogue factions. All the rogue factions are fighting each other, and I represent the rogue faction of the negatively impacted crew of South Pole Station.
Interesting. And those factions in there, yeah, because we have to remember you're dealing with human lives in those types of extreme environments, and the amount of things that they've covered up. I mean, you still have the gigantic cover-up of High Jump, and the files are still sealed, you know, some 80 years later. What it tells us a great deal, I believe. It's a hint there. Yeah. There's the fascinating story about Byrd's son in the 1980s gets invited by this think tank in Washington, D.C., and he lived right in Boston here on Beacon Street, and he takes this train and disappears, shows up a month later dead in a warehouse, and he was going to give the first exposition on High Jump because he was there. He went with his dad.
I didn't know he went with him.
He did. He was 22 years old, and he was there. He was part of the crew. So
that means nothing again, Daniel. That's a big...
Yeah, you go to talk about it, end up in different clothing in a warehouse somewhere. Yeah,
that's wild. Yeah, see, I mean, obviously, Byrd is a big part of this. Berkner is a big part of this. I have no doubt in my mind that, you know, whatever Kennedy and Berkner were going to discuss on the day that he was prevented from talking to Berkner publicly, that it was going to be very Antarctic related. It makes too much sense. It had to have been Antarctic related.
And it's very interesting because Berkner, his strong Antarctica association, having been there, one of the first guys there with Byrd in 1928. I mean, that's as early on this as you get. And then the fact that we have Kennedy, you know, being assassinated by the, you know, of course, in reality, the Patsy, Oswald being in the building owned by another huge Byrd connected piece, which is Dryhole Byrd. It's just, it's an astounding move of history right there. And I think we're still left in that mystery limbo. The question that I want to get to with you is, one of the things that you started to investigate when you left Antarctica had to do with using this type of technology or, say, a mind control or mind influence purpose. I remember having Nick Begich on the show on a number of occasions and him talking to me about HAARP, and I'm sure he got so many questions about HAARP during his career for writing this fantastic book about it. But one of the things in the patent originally was about altering the moods of populations. Yes. That's in the patent, apparently, and it is based on Tesla technology, after all. What did you discover in relation to that? And you seem to kind of dial into a particular idea of this voice to skull type technology. And did you experience that, by the way?
You know something? Well, let me just go linear with the questions that you asked. I would say that Begich's information was very influential, because once I started to realize that these were, you know, different iterations of Tesla technology, and that the South Pole technology was just magnitudes more powerful in capability than what HARP can do, I just started, well, if HARP can do these things, then that should mean that the South Pole technology should be able to do those things and more, and with greater ease and efficiency. So to me, it just moved things from one column to the other. And then in regards to, you know, have I experienced these things? I would say, yeah, absolutely. I refer to them as intrusive thoughts. And this is, I know that you're also a fan of, you know, studying the mystery schools and antiquity. And I am a firm believer that what we are seeing contemporarily are what I would say are bastardized technologies that are replicating ancient techniques.
Interesting. So
back in the day, you know, you can be in the mystery schools and they all had, you know, they all operated under the banner of know thyself. That's really important. Mm-hmm. Right? Because if you don't know these technologies exist, you don't know that the intrusive thought can be applied. Well, we don't need the technology to accomplish that mission. There were people back in the day that could throw their voice. There were people that could mimic a voice. Those were techniques.
Right.
What if you didn't know that technique existed?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Imagine the power somebody can wield over you, Daniel, if they walked into the room and could throw their voice right into your head, so to say, in your voice.
Right.
That would be the application of an intrusive thought by technique.
Mm-hmm.
It's been around for eons. So,
That's fascinating.
Ancient adepts would teach their students to know thyself. So now the interesting thing would be like, well, if I had that skill set, if I was a master of those skills and I tried to apply this to you, the problem that I would have is if I don't know you.
Right.
If I have no intel on you, I can start trying to apply intrusive thoughts, but you know yourself, right? Like, let's just say, for all I know, you don't eat meat, you're a vegetarian. But if I come in and I start trying to manipulate you and I'm like, hey, why don't you go over to the banquet table and grab yourself a burger, and I do it in your voice, you would be thinking, he's like, why am I thinking I want a burger right now?
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't make sense. And you would be a student and you'd be like, ah, there's a wizard in the room trying to manipulate me. And I know that I don't do that. So if you know yourself, you can divine out the intrusive thoughts from your thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in the modern world, that issue still exists. You can't apply the intrusive thoughts to a target that you don't have, let's say, metadata on.
Right. Yes, it's that collection of information.
You have to gather intel on the target to be able to apply intrusive thoughts without the receiver noticing that they don't match the rest of their thoughts. So when you ask me, have I had intrusive thoughts? I would say yes, because they haven't done enough research on me. They don't have enough metadata. I'm not as involved with social media. I pay cash for things so that all of my transactions aren't observed and then metadata gathered. So yes, there are times where all of a sudden a thought pops in my head and I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. That's not me.
You know, I laugh at this, but I want to ask you, do you feel... especially since you brought so much of this out about the secrecy in Antarctica and the time you spent there. I mean, have you felt targeted at any time as a result of your research?
Oh, constantly.
Constantly, yes.
Yeah, I mean, in so many ways. I've been physically threatened more times than I can count. I was physically assaulted in Washington, D.C. There was other whistleblowers, D.C. Long, Stephen Digner, Michael Herrera. They witnessed the tail end of the event. It was an altercation. It was, you know, it happens. I've had family members threatened. I'm constantly harassed online by every type of troll under the sun. People all the time, you know, I've had people say, if you show up to an event, I'm going to knock you out. And I say, I can't wait to get there. Good luck. You know, it is. Yeah. I mean, wow. It is what it is. My mindset is, you never give in to bullies no matter what. I mean, the world suffers from deviating from that norm. Now it's, you know, oh, if, you know, somebody says something bad to you, you know, turn your cheek, walk away. But no, you punch the guy in the face. You know, there's no reason. If we choose to yield to bullyism, they always win. Like it's there's no other way around it.
Interesting. And create an environment where you feel like, well, it's such a hassle. I can't even share this story. And the idea is to discourage you on a very deep mm-hmm. level. But it's interesting to me that you would encounter that, because I feel like there are a lot of people who tell stories and things about Antarctica and they don't go through anything like that because it doesn't threaten this essential order of secrecy that's gone down there. And that there's
their stories aren't true. They're part of the propaganda.
Yeah, right, they're not true. Yeah.
Yeah, that's part of the propaganda to dissuade people from the actual truth. You know, I'll be completely honest. I mean, I respect that Linda Moulton Howe probably had a wonderful career of research back in the day, but the angle that she's firing from now on her Antarctica stuff, I mean, her, Dr. Michael Sollett, they're simply getting bamboozled. I've spoken with both of those people, and to be completely honest, Daniel, right? Like, who's going to be the better party to vet someone having been to Antarctica or not, me or Linda Moulton Howe? How would she know? Sure. So I think she's just being bamboozled by people that are claiming to have gone down there, and she doesn't know any better.
Yeah, this is very interesting, and I feel very strongly about this with the Luna Task Force Committee as well at Congress. You know, they don't have any of the right people around the UFO thing. They have George Knapp telling stories from the 90s. There, you know, that's great, but it doesn't move the needle at all. Right. And then you have these guys, of course, they've run everything from Grush to Chris Mellon's threat program, the UFO threat program that Mellon, the DOD billionaire and cousin of John Warner, and Warner's exposed a lot of his program.
Yeah.
And we've had all kinds of dust ups with Mellon. But what's interesting to me is that the people that they choose to focus on and the narratives they choose to focus on have nothing to do. When you have guys like Eric Burleson, and I say this, you know, wanting to hope that people like Burleson, Burchett, and Luna would go and take this task force and do something remarkable with it before their time is up of doing it. Instead, they're playing this incredibly low-level game with the UFO file, and they're keeping it at a very superficial entertainment level when they could go very deep. If they brought you in tomorrow and they said, here's the UFO file dealing with Antarctica, and if they brought the information that we've put forward about Berkner and others and made that the interface between the JFK research that they are doing, they're letting these things out. Well, here's this declassified document, but they're doing it in a vacuum. And mm-hmm. so if you don't crisscross those two things in that sense, the secrecy around, let's say, a 60-year-old assassination and the secrecy around 80 years of the UFO file, and then the development in Antarctica, that would be exciting. You could blow the entire case wide open. And so this is my problem with it. When you look at it and, you know, just remove my opinion completely, what do you think about what they've presented in terms of whistleblowers and others? And, you know, you mentioned some people there who have tried to go on the record in earnest. But for the majority of them, you know, how do you feel about them?
I see it from top to bottom now. And this is from my experience, my opinion, having, you know, lived the life, gone through the process of attempting to be a good faith whistleblower and observing what these folks did with the information. I am of the opinion this is a completely contrived circus from top to bottom. Everybody is a willing, participating actor. We, the people, are suffering stagecraft. It's a con job. Again, what I was saying earlier about the government. So you're talking about government officials working with it's a show. Warner put it perfectly. It's a thousand ring circus. They just shine the next light on the next ring, and then they set the stage. Oh, and now we got another whistleblower over here. Oh, and now we have a new government official that's going to throw their hat in the ring, and they're here to help us get the truth to you. Bullshit. It's an act. It's an act. They have no intention of getting the truth out there. It is their job to blockade said truth from ever getting to the people. The corporations have the truth. The government does not. People are barking up the wrong tree, knocking on the wrong doors, and being Pied Pipered away while their good-intentioned energies of we the people are being dissipated by very good counterintelligence agents. I mean, I'm sure you've heard of Jake Barber.
Yes.
Right? He's been put out on display now as a whistleblower and a good guy. Jake Barber stated publicly on the Jesse Michaels show that when he went to Washington, D.C. in June of 23, he went there to gather information on whistleblowers. I was one of them.
Oh, yeah.
And it was to help facilitate the FBI with arrests.
Wow. See, this is so important.
And now he's paraded around as the good guy. But what my experience was that they threw a net, they brought in whistleblowers like myself, they gathered information from us, then they repackaged it, redistributed it to their actors to pretend it's their info.
Right, right. And they're using the same talking points, to kind of put in that little dose of authenticity. And they're surrounding it with a completely disinformation narrative. That's what you see going on in the entire UFO file, the UFO disclosure field. That whole UAP wave coming out of TTSA and Elizondo and all the rest of it, which has been shown over and over again to be manipulated. People go back to it again and again.
Yeah. It's very frustrating. I recently came across a document that was leaked on X, and it was apparently an exchange between John Estridge and someone who in this document calls himself Sean Weaver, who I have every reason to believe is Jake Barber, operating under false pretenses.
Yeah.
And with that being said, the document discusses this person's engagement well before June of 23. So I took this document as proof that Barber's lying, saying that, he initially, when he came public, he was saying that, he wasn't involved in disclosure and was a participant in the program willingly until the testimony of Michael Herrera. But I honestly don't see anything don't get me wrong, Herrera's experience is Herrera's experience, but there was nothing from Herrera's testimony that I found so compelling that would get a man that had been acquiescing his whole life, his whole career. There was nothing in Herrera's testimony that would have compelled Barber to be like, I've been on the wrong team for all these years.
He had a great come to Jesus moment with that.
Yeah. There wasn't anything, special there to compel the black team agents to switch sides.
Right.
So I think what we witnessed was that Barber went there as a faction for the corporations. To try to get their hooks into people and convert them towards an operation that would sidestep and dissipate the energies of good-intentioned whistleblowers. Those folks tried to get their hooks into me at that event, and I refused because I'm few and far between will I fall to the love bombing and desires of collaboration from these factions. I've seen it too many times now. I played a very patient game that every time somebody jumps up and is like, you're doing the right thing and I want to help you, I go, just go away. Factions try to get at you. They want to come up and be buddy-buddy with you. We see Lou Elizondo doing this all over the place, and people suck it up because they want to be buddy-buddy with Lou. The freaking torture czar.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, my pal unlikely, Lou.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, how could you go to a guy like that for the truth around the UFO file, which is so heavily covered over by the secrecy of the intelligence agencies? And it's interesting because when they start to choose other whistleblowers, they choose them from institutions that are honeycombed with CIA players. So when you get the NGA people, the NSA people, and the NRO people, they're all trained by the same CIA people. So it comes back to that central thing. And their job is to create this story around the UFO file. And they obviously figured out we can't keep this thing bottled up. What we'll do is we'll make a threat story.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's par for the course. They don't want to discuss that 99% of the stuff that we see in the sky is ours. They certainly don't want that getting out there. So the cover story currently is it's them. It's the aliens. Oh, and they're a threat. So, by the way, we're going to need more checks cut so that, you know, we can get rid of that threat.
Right.
You know, since we don't have that tech, we're going to have to invest in it. So, like, this to me, it's like 9/11 all over again. Like, you know, September 10th, we get the DOD telling us, oh, we lost $2.3 trillion. Sorry about that. And then on 9/11, it's like, oh, son of a gun, we're going to need you guys to start cutting checks again. We have a big dilemma.
It's incredible discrepancies. And of course, we know now it goes much further up the chain in terms of the amount of money that's missing. When you think about the secret development, and I'm going to kind of wind our conversation all around to this, which is you've been in the middle of that secrecy and the after effects of it. When you look at Antarctica and you look at the enigma of the UFO file, heavily shrouded in secrecy on both sides. What is the crisscross? What is the factor that draws them both together? That is, give me the combination of the UFO file in Antarctica.
I think it has a lot to do with there's been more high tech going on for a lot longer than we can really comprehend. So, like, you know, when Ben Rich said, you know, anything that you can think of, you know, we've already done it. I think we already did it way before he ever said that. Mm-hmm. To the tune of like what Pharrell and Bosley are getting at, you know, that back in the 1860s, this was being looked at. I mean, I'm doing research about the greater Long Island area, the Germans there, the aerospace engineering corporations. I'm pushing for a case at this point. Can't prove it yet. I really believe that the whole Wright Brothers North Carolina event was contrived to draw people off what was already going on in the greater Long Island area.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, there's no question.
Everybody knows that North Carolina, that, you know, they coined the term first in flight. Well, Long Island is referred to as the cradle of aviation.
So, interesting. Yeah.
It happened almost immediately. We went from, you know, bicycle mechanics whipping some pipes and cloth together in North Carolina, and then almost overnight, there's a fully functioning aerospace industry all over Long Island cranking out every kind of plane you can imagine, and tons of seaplanes, experimental planes. It just in the blink of an eye.
It is fascinating. And of course, the Cosmos Club is around this, and the Wright brothers were housed at the Cosmos Club while all this was taking place. And the Cosmos Club, again, is that interface when you get around the Delshow material, the airship material, and this whole piece, a lot of the people who are associated with this Cosmos Club, like Tillman and others, are the ones who are seen in relation, you know, landing the ships and things and identifying themselves, saying, hi, I'm S.C. Tillman, you know. So there's an incredible thing you're raising there, which is it's a much older. I have to ask you, since it's Long Island, has Montauk showed up in your research at all?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. There's a lot to be said for that. The SAGE radar system that was out there was a savage system. It held the record for being like one of the longest military systems to exist without something coming in to be better than it. It ran for like 60 years or something before they came up with a system that was able to replace it because it was so ahead of the curve. One of the most fascinating facts I think about Montauk Point, the first thing that George Washington did as president was go out to Montauk Point and commission the Montauk Lighthouse.
Wow. Yeah. That tells you a great deal.
Yeah. I mean, step one was, you know, we need a lighthouse right here, you know, and it's not like it's easy to get out there at the time. Well, there's a lot of reports from back in the day of German submarines entering into what was, you know, submerged access points in the Montauk area. So again, the connection between Germans, Long Island, and high technology seems to be going on for a lot longer than most people have even begun to delve.
That is fascinating. And when you think about something like Brookhaven, and you think about the particle acceleration, mm-hmm. we have the whole CERN problem over in Switzerland, but it started mm-hmm. here. Mm-hmm. And you know, the particle acceleration yep. and the particle beam weapon aspect, that takes me right back into what you were describing about Antarctica and these beams. And we've had these stories recently about these beams being fired off from Antarctica mm-hmm. towards the direction of Australia. And I don't know how authentic those reports are, by the way. And yet it seems to fit this pattern of demonstration experiment that you were talking about. And in the case of Christchurch, New Zealand event, somehow, you know, either it got out of hand or it was intended to create the disruption that it did as a test of this weapon.
I'm sure that you've probably heard that Nikola Tesla has said that there are certain places on this planet that are better for experimenting with energy than other places.
Yes, absolutely. So
Nikola Tesla tapped the Wardenclyffe location on Long Island as being one of those positions.
Right, of course, yes.
Nobody seems to have ever argued with that reality. They've only enforced it because Brookhaven National Labs is right across the street from where Wardenclyffe was.
Right, exactly.
The Shoreham Nuclear Power Plant is 2 minutes up the road from where Wardenclyffe was. Camp Siegfried, the German-American bone stronghold after World War II, was right there also.
Incredible.
There's tons of pictures of Nazis in full regalia marching through the streets that is this energy study area.
Wow.
Back to the Nassau County area of Long Island and what I've been looking into, the German heritage and the original settlers, literally right in the community where I grew up, I remember seeing this sign. And when I went back with a friend of mine, James Oliva, who's a researcher from New York that I got engaged with, I was showing him some of the sites and some of the things that I knew about Long Island. And I brought him to this spot where there's an old German church and graveyard. And there's a sign there referencing the original settlers and when the first Germans settled this particular area, they referred to it as the New Jerusalem.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So, I mean, a lot of people can sit here and say, well, that doesn't really mean anything, but you're someone that studies these things. It may not mean anything to us today, but I assure you that back in the day, they didn't just decide to call it the New Jerusalem lightly.
Right. Well, and think about New Schwabenland, of course, this, you know, Valhalla or the German Nazis going down there and using birds' information and guidance to be like, hey, you know, we need all this from you. Eric, absolutely fascinating. I have a second planned show with you if you're up for it.
Absolutely.
After this one. So we'll schedule that because we need to have you back on. We've covered so much here, but I want to go deeper and even open up the subject. You've gone very deep on this today. Extraordinary research. How can people help you get behind your research and where can they find you?
The best place would be to go to my website. I'm trying to get outside of all these censorship platforms and social media things. I have a website, deciphering.tv. It's been out for a couple of years, and I'm actually going to be bringing on some more excellent researchers and content creators because I'm sick and tired of the debacle that we see out there. And I do really believe that we, the people, you know, can work together. Many hands makes light work and a rising tide raises all ships. So I've been working hard to find diamonds in the rough and I'm going to grow this platform and try to do the best that I can to, you know, work with, you know, geniuses like you and Pharrell and Bosley that are doing real research and finding actionable intelligence instead of all this speculative stagecraft that we're suffering. So yeah, people can go to my website and you know, share stuff. There's an archive section where I have documentation. People can peruse it, download it. But that would be really appreciated from the audience. I'm also on X, which I'm very easy to find there. So if they want to, you know, engage me there is sometimes easier for folks. And I do some X spaces and things like that. And I'm pretty easy to get a hold of for anybody out there that has, you know, dots to connect and you know, wants interviews. So people can find me.
Oh, that's fantastic. The if I were to say here to the Luna committee and the task force people that you'd be willing to testify before that committee, would you be able to say that that's true?
Absolutely. I'm actively, I guess you would say, courting or being courted by politicians. But again, this is part of my experience. I'm learning it doesn't bear fruit. So like in one breath, I would like, Daniel, absolutely. I would go and testify again. If you said, Eric, do you think anything will become of it? I'd say no.
Right. Well,
say to you, sir, I would say, sir, watch and learn what happens. Testify again. And you tell me if it was worth my effort.
Right, exactly. And yet I think you could smash open the congressional hearings in that task force environment, which is so controlled and so, you know, heavily kind of based towards the lack of knowledge on the part of Luna and Burchett, regardless of their intentions, is astonishing around the UFO file. And you're getting this fluff on top and you're getting the kind of Elizondo Grush and all the rest of that. I think that, you know, they should have a challenge online publicly here that you will speak before them publicly in that committee or about these issues. And I think that that would be a fantastic thing. I'd like to see it happen.
I would love to engage this in any arena. The way that I've been saying this is I'm a champion for the truth. I'm engaged in the battle for disclosure. This is a war, like Alex Jones says, info wars. Like this is very legitimate. I champion my crew from the South Pole Station. I champion we the people of this planet, because these technologies, we are actively suffering under it. There is a war going on. The factions are fighting to be king of the mountain. The governments have no control over it. And we the people are caught in the crossfire, and there's walking wounded everywhere.
Wow, that is fascinating. And it's your research and your experience that is shaking up the whole conversation around directed energy weapons in Antarctica, and this inevitably draws us into the UFO file. So that's where I want people to go for this. I look forward to more with you, and we'll do a program with you. I have something special in mind, so I'll get in touch with you.
Awesome.
And we'll put that together. It's fantastic to talk with you. And of course, we need to get our pal John Warner back on the scene as well, because he's such an excellent and important voice in all this.
Absolutely. Yeah, I love chatting with John. That would be a great conversation for sure.
That's great. Okay, Eric, we'll talk soon. And of course, this will come right out. It's fantastic to have you here, and more to come.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Daniel. Have an excellent day, and I appreciate the fight that you're doing as well.
Okay, that's great. Talk to you soon.
Have a great day, sir.